Acts 16 is where we are and where we've left off. We want to pick up with Acts 16, 34. You may remember that in Acts chapter 16, the jailer comes into the jail and sees Paul and Silas. All the prisoners are there. He's told not to harm himself. And he asks, what must I do to be saved? He's thinking about salvation in a personal sense. He also understands or believes that he is required to do something. The answer in verse 31 of Acts 16, believe. Pointed out how that seems to be an aggressive error, that is, start believing. It was not just, well, I accept Jesus into my heart. If you stay in the jail an hour longer, you find in verse 32 that they spoke the word of the Lord unto him. He had to know what to do. He was taught. Took them the same hour of the night, was baptized. Verse 33, also washed their stripes. That then brings us to verse 34. The man, his household has been baptized. He brings them up unto his house, sets food before them, rejoices greatly with all his house, having believed in God. Let's compare what this guy did with what Lydia did. Do you remember what Lydia does back in Acts chapter 16? She is taught. She's also baptized. Acts chapter 16 and verse 15. And then what'd she say? Yeah. And just not come home with me. Did she say, well, yeah, you guys have a chance to drop by. That would be good. What's the Bible say in Acts 16? I think it's 15. Yeah, and she constrained them. She urged them. She said, you guys really need to come and stay at my house. What does that tell you after Lydia was converted? What did she do? I'm going to show up twice a week and sit in a pew.
She immediately went into action.
All right, she went into action. She said, if I become a Christian, I understand that I have some responsibilities. I realize that now I need to start living my life, at least in some respects, in a different way. She immediately begins to act. Do we see that same thing here in Acts chapter 16 with the jailer? Yes. If we find some patterns in the Bible as far as examples to follow, would you say that this is an example that we need to follow? After somebody's baptized, what needs to be a message to them? Yeah. That's a nice summation. That's putting it rather bluntly, but that's also putting that very plainly. Get busy, and we'll help you. What if we have a young person who is baptized? Somebody who's 15, 16, 17, 18. It's really easy for that person to become a Christian, and then what do? We sideline them. We ignore them. And we sort of sometimes have the mentality, well, when you do what? Okay, you get married, you grow up, or you get past high school, then what can happen? Then we'll have you participate. I think we've done a good job here congregationally of not falling into that trap, but that can be a problem. Luke noted how the jailer offered Paul and Silas medical attention when? Before or after he was baptized? Before. I mentioned to you last week an old quote. It would be like people today. Anybody ever gone to a doctor and been stitched up? All right. A few admit that. All right. What happens is the stitches are being put in. I mean, you're probably conscious. You can talk. You're not all drugged up. Maybe they've numbed the pain a little bit. They've given you a local. But what happens usually is the stitches are put in by the doc or the nurse or whoever that is.
You chat.
All right. There's a conversation, you know, and maybe they're trying to get your mind off of it, or maybe they want to know how it happened, or maybe they're just bored, whatever that is. But there's usually a conversation taking place. That's just the way that typically it works. So if this guy is washing the stripes, what do you think is probably happening? I mean, if you're the preacher and you are committed to teaching the gospel of Christ in every place that you can, and this guy says, I'm interested, I've asked what to do about salvation, and he's washing the back or washing the arms or washing the legs, whatever that body part might be, what do you think you're going to be doing?
Teaching.
Well, he's asked what to do. I'm going to give you some medical attention, and then I don't know that exactly, they may not have had every stripe taken care of, but he's definitely learned enough. He is baptized, and then he, as Luke 16:34 says, brings them up to the house. One of the things that catches my attention is, when were they fed? Before or after the baptism? After. You think these guys are probably hungry? Given the sequence of events, that makes a lot of sense. And you might think from a non-Christian perspective, if you want to be helpful, feed them when? I mean, it's getting later. It's already in the midnight time period. There's no sense in letting the night get any further. Let's feed you some food. And maybe he even offered that.
But if baptism is required, then it would make sense to, I mean, if God says this is really something that you need, otherwise you're going to be lost, then it makes perfect sense to do what with the food? We're going to wait on that, and we're going to, you can take care of the medical attention while we talk to you, but after we get everything fixed up, then we'll come back and eat. It's interesting to me that if you flip over a little later in the book of Acts, Acts chapter 24, verse 23, you have here a hint as far as how things worked in the ancient world when it came to people who were incarcerated. Acts 24, 23, and gave order to the centurion that he should be kept in charge and should have indulgence and not to forbid any of his friends to come and do what? Minister to him. If they take you to jail now, are you going to get fed? Yeah, may not be what you want, but they're going to feed you. Are they going to clothe you? Are they going to give you a roof over your head? You know, you're probably going to get at least 2 squares, maybe 3 squares a day. Go to prison, you're going to get the same thing? Yeah. But if you were back there in the first century, you go to a prison, and guess who feeds you? You better have some friends, because if you don't have any friends, it's going to be tough cookies. You're probably not going to fare too well. That's the way it was in ancient times. You see that reflected in Acts chapter 24. Somebody says, well, that's harsh. That doesn't seem like that was very nice. It was important, and it wasn't very nice. Another passage that may come to mind, remember over there in Matthew chapter 25 where Jesus talks to the saved at the end of time, blessed are ye, come my Father, prepared for you, the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the earth. And then the righteous will say, why, Lord, what do we do? And Jesus will say, I was hungry. I was where? I was in prison, and you came to visit me. It's really easy to look at that word visit and think, well, we went down to the jail for 10 minutes and saw Brother Joe. Well, okay, that's probably a good thing to do. But when Jesus spoke those words, the people who heard those words were probably thinking, that means go down, see that person who's been incarcerated for his faith, and bring some food, maybe some medical supplies, or maybe even some goodies. Help that person out. Anything that you want to add or ask before we talk about the rejoicing? Stan?
I think it's interesting that every one of these verses, when it talks about them being taught, et cetera, it always says him and his household.
I'm moving right there. But go ahead and say what you want, but that's where I was headed next.
Well, okay, maybe I could prompt some comments. That strikes me because today you don't see it happen very frequently. As a matter of fact, sometimes it takes, if you're fortunate or blessed, hours, a lot of times days, sometimes years before you can teach one individual. And even then, maybe a spouse will listen in, but you don't very often have more than one baptism at a time. And I've never heard of a household. On top of that, this happened within hours. And I'm kind of curious about your thoughts on their having gained the faith to do this within such a short period of time and such a number of people.
Okay, about two or three things there. Let's see if we can unpack them little by little, and then we'll talk about the rejoicing. When you look at cultures, obviously things are different. Even in America, if you were to go back 40 years in our country, you would think kind of Wally Cleaver for a lot of households. There would be the mom, she would be the traditional thing, she would be married, and the dad would be doing, you know, I'm going to go to work every day, and mom's going to pack me lunch, and then mom packs lunch for the kids and works around the house. Dad comes home and mows the grass, and it's hopefully one big family that is relatively happy. That model is sometimes, and I would say in secular universities, oftentimes ridiculed. If you hold up the traditional family, the lines have been blurred, and we've seen that in a lot of different ways, that, you know, men are, you know, can do all the things that women can do all the things that men can do, and we've seen same-sex households, and the family has just been turned upside down. It's been attacked in so many ways. I mention that to say that a family structure can go a lot of different directions. There's God's plan. We see the mess that we have in our society. If we were to look in other cultures, we would see places that would be like we had sort of in the 50s, where the dad was the leader of the house. But even more so, in those places, and there are still some, it would be like a tribal culture today, where the chief says, hey, this is right, and the whole village converts. There are cases of that in places like Africa where the male figure, the chief, or in this case, the person who is in the person who's the head of the household, if he makes a decision like that, in this case, a religious decision, the others would fall in line. That gets really interesting with Christianity, because Christianity, as we talked about before, is a matter of free will. Having said that, it would seem to me that the teaching would say this is, can we say, voluntary? This is an individual choice. But once again, it would be, well, maybe we can compare it to elders in a local congregation. If the elders say, we've gotten all this information, the congregation has at least some of the information that the elders have, the elders are moving forward in a good way, the congregation says, okay, you know, these are our leaders, we're going to go ahead and follow. Now, they could obviously go in a different direction because they have free will. But generally speaking, it can flow in that kind of way. That's what I see here. It was a household that heard the gospel, made sense to them. The leader of the household, the jailer, said, I want to become a Christian. And the other said, yes, that's a good decision, and we're also going to get on board with that.
It seems to me like you mentioned the fact that it is something that is determined by a person's own free will, that to follow, and I understand what you're saying, and that makes sense, but how is a person actually converted? Were those who were part of the household actually converted, or they just simply said, well, Dad says you're doing this, so you do it?
Maybe we can get some insight on that question from the jailer. When you think about the jailer and the things that happened, had he been of a different personality or mindset, had his character been different, could you foresee the jailer acting in a different way?
Yeah.
I mean, I can see some guys, you know, he would just go in and kill him. He wouldn't think twice. It's kind of like, we have a disaster here. But here Paul calls out and says, we're all here. And then what's he do? He's got a heart that is willing to receive the gospel of Christ. If he already has that kind of heart, you can imagine the kind of household that he was trying to lead and rule over. Now, if he's a tyrant, that's one thing. The tyrant would say, well, I'm going to become a Christian, and hey, you do too. Or you get the axe, or I'm going to cast you out. And that's what he could have done with servants. Because of the character that you have reflected, though, in this guy, it would make sense to me to say they also heard, they were told, and it, with that kind of character, I can foresee that somebody might say, in this case I'm talking about the jailer, I'm going to become a Christian. What you do is up to you. If you don't want to become a Christian, you can still stay at the house. I'm still going to be nice to you. All those things are going to be as they were before. But this is going to be my decision. If I were in that kind of household, that would certainly incline me rather than disincline me to become a Christian. So we'll let you munch on that for a little bit, and then we'll take a couple of the hands of verse being done.
Well, I believe in reading this in Joshua, when he said, be in my household.
Yes.
Yeah, that means that's a big household.
Yeah, there's another example where he was speaking for the group. He was trying to lead his family in the right way, and they had confidence in that leadership. Now, they could have obviously rebelled. I mean, a 2-year-old can rebel.
But in that culture back there, you didn't rebel against the leader.
Yes.
The father or the patriarch or whatever.
Yes.
That really doesn't work today. And I don't think we want it to work today. We don't want to be established saying, were they converted or are they forced to be converted?
Yeah.
We want them to be converted in free will, knowing exactly what they were getting stepping into. Otherwise, we week or two or a year down the road, they're going to fall off.
Yeah. I've actually had some Bible studies where you're talking to multiple people, and that was another one of the questions there. You can study with multiple people, and we don't want to, I think, assume that the jailer was the only one washing the wounds. If you've got two wounded guys, it could have been that you've got a servant over here, he's getting the water, you've got somebody over here maybe trying to make up some salve, and another guy trying to, you know, maybe pick some pieces of dirt out of the wounds, whatever that might be. It could have been a household job. And you see how the preachers have responded, and you're listening to the gospel as a group. But I've had cases where, let's say that I'm studying with three people, one says, boy, I'm ready to be baptized now. Another says, I think I need another day. And the other person says, I'm not really interested. Well, okay, you've all three made your decision. And oftentimes that was in some kind of family relationship. And at least for a while, one was a Christian, the other one became one shortly thereafter, and perhaps the other one never became one. Ray, did you have a thought? And then I'm going to go back to Brian.
I'm just thinking of Cornelius.
Okay, there's another one.
For Peter when he got there.
Yeah.
So he was prepared for that.
Yeah. Lydia and her household, there's another one. You do have multiple households in the New Testament, and it goes back to, I don't know if you want to use the word patriarchal, but there was that very, very strong sense of male leadership. And if that male leadership is trusted, just like in a congregation, you generally have everybody on the same page. Brian?
My example is Cornelius 2, back in chapter 10, when Peter was recounting it. He said that Cornelius was told, send men to Joppa for Peter, for Simon, say to Peter, you shall tell these words, whereby thou and all in thy house shall be saved. Mm-hmm. So it was a household thing, but they all got the words.
Yes.
So it's still the word, at least in that example, words were taught to all of them.
Yes. And that would be helpful, I think, as far as establishing that people use their free will. It wasn't, let's take the leader of the household, tell him what to do, and then he comes back and says, you guys have to do this. But they all heard because they all had the right and the need to make an individual choice. Tim?
In all these cases that we're talking about, there seems to be a great deal of respect for the main character, even the jailer. And the story tells us that the jailer was not a bad person. He had a bad job, but he wasn't a bad person. And of course, the Christians there were good people. And I think the jailer, as well as Cornelius' household and others, they wanted to be associated with people like that. They saw that their life could be a lot better. And they had respect one for the other, and that helped them a lot.
It did. Okay, thank you. Let's stick with a household for just a little bit longer. Luke says that who rejoiced? The jailer rejoiced with who?
Those who
relate to all his house. Okay, all his house. Now somebody might say that's taking a little bit too far, but if you're rejoicing with all your house, what does that suggest about the age of the people that you're rejoicing with?
They were buried, more likely.
They were?
The age was probably buried.
Well, yes, but up there. They were accountable. No infants in the household. You begin to see, as you look at the household conversions, indications of that little by little, and here you have that indicated here. The words greatly rejoice come from a verb which described, I'll give you the quote, the joy and exultation over the salvation which God has given and promised through Jesus. So basically they became a Christian, and he was ecstatic about that. Another source said that this is rejoicing to the fullest extent. I like that definition. You think about the thing which will fill you up completely with joy. There are a lot of people who think, well, if I can get my new car, if I can stop wearing my mask, if I can finally get out to the grocery store, that will just please me to no end. There's something better than that. When you look at the word rejoicing, it's also used back there in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 12, where Jesus applied that to Christians. He said, rejoice. He said, your reward is going to be exceedingly great. Let me toss this out for your consideration. What kind of food was set before Paul and Silas?
Meat.
They got meat and potatoes?
It just says meat.
All right, I think that's a general term for food. Thinking in terms of general food, what do you think they, what do you think he got?
Bread.
Well, I didn't ask my question well. Let me. I do that sometimes. Quality of food, not actually what they ate.
Regular stuff.
Okay.
Whatever their normal food that they ate.
Okay. You don't think he served them slop?
No.
You think he could have served them the best he had? I mean, if you've got this joy, I mean, if somebody has made you thrilled beyond measure, and you know they're hungry, most people with a decent heart will probably try to offer them, if not at least the regular food, a couple steps up. And maybe we've been holding this back. We've got some really good stuff, and we're going to set it out for you. Anybody ever been really hungry? I mean, really hungry? I don't know if I've ever told you this. I might have. I was thinking I'd share this with you. But it's coming out of Russia, trying to get back to Moscow one time. And we'd been, the translator and I, we'd been traveling for about 2 days. And we, we got on this bus. She wasn't sure we knew where we were going. And we got off on this bus in the middle of nowhere. I kid you not. And I had been given some gifts. My hands were bleeding because, I mean, I had two suitcases that were just cutting into my hands. And we had just really gone through the rigmarole. And finally we get off this bus, and there is in the distance, and I mean in the distance, it looked like it was about 3 miles out, some lights. And she said, I think the person that we need to find, and I'm thinking, okay, my plane ticket, I can see the date I'm supposed to leave, and you know, the hours are ticking down. She said, I think he's up there in the lights. Well, that wasn't really encouraging. So, I mean, we walked the 3 miles or whatever it was, and I mean, it was just unbelievable. And then we get there, and if things still are as they were at that time, a lot of the elevators are broken, and he was up on like the sixth floor. So, you know, you're going up, and I mean, now it's about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was supposed to be at the airport around five, and bloody hands. And it turned out that we did find he was a doctor. He was a plastic surgeon. And I knocked on the door and got him up, and he said, yeah, we're the people who can help you. We're the contact. They weren't Christians. He was just somebody that wanted to make some extra money on the side. And I still remember the wife got up, and that was the only time in life where I ate some rice. And I mean, that's I went through all that to tell you, I mean, I have eaten rice once, but I was just so tired. I mean, I just collapsed, had a little food. But I've still thought about that. Gave him $20, which was a ton of money. For some people, that was almost a month's salary to use his gas in the car and get me to Moscow. A couple hours after we got there. But there was that family that late at night got them up out of bed and come in, you know, this guy's bleeding all over, and, you know, cook him something to eat. He looks haggard. It does happen. And people have, oh, I meant to do one other thing for you. I forgot. I don't think it was that trip. But in Ukraine, asked to speak at a little group they were meeting. And they had kind of a preacher's house in the back. So I went back there afterwards, and the couple, an older couple, they were 60-ish, wanted to give me something to remember them by. I said, not necessary. Yeah. So they gave me their salt and pepper shakers. That was all they had to give me. I've still got little red salt and pepper shaker set, and I've still got that back in the office. Once again, I tell you that to show you that when people are taught the gospel of Christ, if they really understand what it is, if they really realize or comprehend what they have been given, the value of it, the greatness of it. I mean, it's just, there's no possession that we have that we could give you that's enough to show you appreciation. And that salt and pepper set continues to remind me of how thankful they were that I came. Anybody want to say anything before we pick up with some introductory remarks on verses 35 to 40? Okay, a couple quick points here. Let's pick up a cross-reference, 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 2. I want to give you a little bit of a contrast. 1 Thessalonians 2:2. When Paul talks to the Thessalonians a little bit later, he's going to go back and talk about his experience at Philippi, what we've been talking about. Remember, he's cast into not only the prison, he's cast into the inner prison. He's been beaten, and it's really been rough. Here's how he describes it. 1 Thessalonians 2:2. Who has it? All right, Brian?
And even after that, we have suffered before, and
okay, Paul faced throughout his life all kinds of hardships, but he reminds the Thessalonians, he says, at Philippi, things were bad.
we were shamefully treated. Well, here's what Luke does with that. Luke almost turns it into once said a comic upturn that ironically inverts the suffering. Here's how he does it in his account. He says these guys were cast into prison. It didn't look all that good for them. But then who has to show up to get them out? All right, the magistrates, the people who are the big leaders, they have to come, and do they just unlock the door? What do? Well, they've just about got to get on the hands and knees and beg. They plead with them to go, so it does seem kind of ironic. These guys want them cast in, then they got to come and say, please, 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 go out. Then you have these fellas, the missionaries, Paul and Silas, they're publicly beaten. They're imprisoned for their non-Roman practices. Romans chapter 16 and verse 21. These guys are doing stuff that Romans don't do. And then what's the irony? Paul says, oh guys, guess what? We are Romans. So there's a narrative that begins with their humiliation, and it ends with the humiliation of the public officials. Luke just kind of turns things around from two or three different perspectives. And that's not exactly what Paul was thinking when he gets to the Thessalonian letter. Acts chapter 16, let's look at verses 35 and 36. But, there's our contrast again. But when it was day, we've seen what was taking place at night. They got fed, they got out of jail, there was the earthquake, they were baptizing people. But when it was day, the magistrates sent the sergeant saying, let these men go. And the jailer reported the words to Paul saying, the magistrates have sent to let you go. Now therefore, come forth and go in peace. But begins to contrast the late night baptisms with the kind treatment that begins the next day, and also it takes readers back to these people who oppose the preaching of the gospel. Anybody remember who the sergeants were? Literally, that word means the rod carriers. Who are these sergeants? How would you describe them in today's terms? All right, if punishment needed to be inflicted, they were going to be the people who did that. They were lower level people. They were the attendants. They were the orderlies. They were the people who were sort of in the trenches. And they have received word from the magistrates. The magistrates, of course, were those very powerful, the leading officials, that Paul and Silas were to be released. And now not only to be released, but what? You go and you go in peace. Isn't that rich? You guys, you're good. Don't worry about it. What's said about the earthquake? Verse 26. Not a word. What's said about possible escapees? Not a word. What's said about the jail? Nothing is said about the jail. I wonder, because of how ancient people thought, and still you'll find this in the world, if they weren't thinking maybe the earthquake was an omen. And because of everything that happened, maybe we need to let these guys go. The jailer might have been a little concerned about what to do. He's become a Christian. He had obviously clear respect for Paul and Silas. He referred to them, we talked about, as sir or lord. But now, on the other hand, he's received this word, which is sort of like case closed, just shut things down. And maybe rather than make a decision on what to do, he reported the words to Paul. Paul's response, of course, is found in verses 37 and 38. Anything that you want to touch on before we pick up with those next two verses? Acts 16, 37 and 38, once again, a but. But Paul said to them, that is, these sergeants, they have beaten us publicly, uncondemned, or I'm sorry, I'm going to come back to the them. But Paul said unto them, they have beaten us publicly, uncondemned, men that are Romans, and have cast us into prison, and do they now cast us out privily? Nay, verily, but let them come themselves and bring us out. And the sergeants reported these words unto the magistrates, and they feared when they heard that they were Romans. The jailer does what the magistrates have wanted done, that is, he communicates the information to Paul, and Paul spoke to them. I made the mistake, not intentionally, but I made the mistake, I said them. Normally we would think them would refer back to who? The magistrates. Here, though, who do you think it refers back to? Well, maybe. Anybody else, possibly? I'm thinking it's a jailer and his household. I'm wondering if maybe that information didn't come. There were some people perhaps in the household, and you can maybe imagine perhaps joy on the part of the jailer. Hey guys, guess what? We're coming with news.
you get to get out. Well, Paul says to them, to the household, that's not going to work. Then he reminds, if we're talking about the household, the jailer, of the unfair treatment that they'd experienced. Number one, he says, we were beaten. We want to come back to that word. He says, number two, the beating had been public or the beating had been private. Bad enough if it had been in private, but it had been public. And then he said, we were also condemned or uncondemned. We were not condemned. There was nothing like a trial. And they'd been put where? They'd been cast into prison. And those actions were legal because he and Silas both had Roman citizenship. Notice that the officials wanted to deal with this how? This is in the middle of verse 37.
Secretly.
Yeah. Do we find that kind of thing today?
At times we do.
Yes. Before we talk about that, let's phrase it a little differently. They want to deal with this privately. What's their expression for that? They want to... There we go. About three people got it and somebody else had a different answer. They want to sweep it under the rug. We hear that. Well, folks, that's in the Bible. That's what these people wanted to do. They wanted to sweep it under the rug. Where do we see that at? Government. A lot of times, at virtually every level, there is some big scandal. Well, you know, don't worry about that. Just sweep it under the wet rug, get rid of it. Not new. Let's talk about the verb beaten for a little bit. I want to run into some cross-references here. Let's get some helpers lined up. Matthew 21 and verse 35. We'll get that one on deck. I've got about five of them. So if you volunteer, you have time to get there. Gary, after that, we'll take a look at Mark chapter 13 and verse 9. This one also, Steve, that'll be you. That also has the same word, Mark 13:9. Then let's go back to the Old Testament. This obviously doesn't have the same word. It's a different language. But I want to give you a cross-reference. 2 Chronicles 36. 2 Chronicles 36, verses 15 and 16. Betty, after that we'll take a look at Luke chapter 12, verses 47 and 48. Luke 12, 47 and 48. Jenny, and then we'll take a look at Luke chapter 22 and verse 63. Luke, Tina, Luke 22, 63. And finally we want Acts chapter 22 and verse 19. Acts 22, that'll be Carol. Acts 22, verse 19. Let's start with Matthew chapter 21 and verse 35.
And the husbandman took his servants and beat one and killed another and stoned another.
Jesus, as he's talking about what God's people had done to God's servants, he says God had sent people like prophets. We have several in the Old Testament that were not treated or not received very well. John the Baptist, how was he treated? Some were baptized, but there were others like the religious officials. What did they say?
No, he's a bad guy.
Yeah, he was not the guy. They kind of came and looked at him and said, nope. And how did John die? Yeah, he was beheaded. So he certainly was not received very well. Jesus, as he talks about God's servants, he says some of them were beaten. This is perhaps, unless we see something like Rodney King, or unless we see something that's taking place with some of the riots, we, at least for me, I don't generally think about people being beaten in the U.S., do you? The only time you hear about a beating, perhaps, unless it's a big news story like the Rodney King story, a riot story, is someone beating a child. But for the most part, a beating of an adult, that just does not seem to be taking place. But God's people did suffer that, Matthew 21 and verse 35. Jesus said that, and the beatings sometimes were from the heathens, as we see in Acts chapter 16, but sometimes from God's people, Matthew 21 and verse 35. Mark chapter 13 and verse 9 is next.
Watch out for yourselves, for they will deliver you up to councils, and you will be beaten in the synagogues. You will be brought before rulers and kings for my sake, for testimony to them.
Can you imagine if you were a Jew preaching the gospel of Christ, you go into a synagogue, and you're beaten in the synagogue? For me, that's hard to imagine. But Jesus said to his people that if you're going to teach my word, is going to be one of the things that you suffer. That wasn't a new problem. 2 Chronicles chapter 36, 15 and 16. Betty, I think that's you, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
15 and 16.
Yep, from 36.
Lord, the God of their fathers, sent to them by his messengers, rising up early and ascending, because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. They mocked the messengers of God and despised his words and scoffed at his prophets, until the wrath of the Lord rose against his people, until there was another.
Okay, God's people, as far as those who have tried to speak for him, have not been treated well for a long, long time. 2 Chronicles 36 indicates that. The word that we're looking at also reinforces that. And one of the things that really seems unfair as far as treatment that falls into the persecution realm is a beating. But God says, if you face that, or those who have faced that, things are going to be changed one day. Let's take a look at Luke chapter 12, 47 to 48. Thank you. That's interesting. Jesus, in talking about the unsaved, describes those who are outside of Christ at the end of time as being beaten. And he says some are going to receive many stripes, some few. That's not the point of discussion right now. But he does say every single person will suffer punishment. And that punishment is described in terms of a beating. That, to me, is not a very pleasant picture for those who are outside of Christ. But that is one way to establish that the people who have tried to do what's wrong will one day have things flipped around. In talking about the word that's used in Acts chapter 16 and verse 37, we also have Luke chapter 22 and verse 63. Let's take a look at that one next.
And the men that held Jesus mocked him and smote him.
I like that passage for this reason. Somebody says, Lord, you promised that we might be beaten, even by your own people. At least when the Jews were God's people. I have been beaten, but what would Jesus be able to say? Me first. I also suffered that same fate. I know exactly what that's like. Our last reference comes from Acts chapter 22 and verse 19. Now think about that. One synagogue after another, beaten and beaten and beaten. Very sad, but it was a huge problem. Thankfully, at least at the present time, we don't have that in the U.S. That could change at one point. If officials wanted Paul and Silas to leave the area, Paul said, what was going to have to happen? You want us to go? You're going to have to come and get us. That is a worthwhile point to consider for a couple of reasons. Sometimes people, as they look at the Christian life, they say, well, because of what Jesus taught about turning the other cheek, people should be able to do to me whatever they want. Was that Paul's attitude here? No. He said, you've committed wrong, you've done evil, and you're not going to be able to sweep this under the rug. There is something that must be done, and that is you, the officials, must come and release us personally. Would you say that they turned the other cheek in any sense? Matthew 5 and verse 39. Would you say that Paul and Silas turned the other cheek in any sense? Or they did not do that on this occasion?
No, they didn't turn the other cheek.
You don't think they did? All right, so we've got a no. Anybody want to take the yes side? Okay, anybody else want to toss in a comment or two? All right, I'll put a comment on Don's statement. If they want to sweep it under the rug, does Paul sort of let that happen? I mean, the word's probably going to get out a little bit. I mean, if you got these guys, these officials, these high officials, can you imagine? Let's change the illustration a little bit. Who's our governor?
Holcomb.
All right, we all know. Holcomb. I wasn't asking because I didn't know. You have this fellow who's been locked up, and it's determined that he needs to be let out. He was not guilty of a crime, and there was a big to-do. If it's going to occur as far as this man's release, how's that probably going to happen?
Just kind of letting
the governor probably take a piece of paper and say, well, I signed the release for him, And then that'll filter down through all the channels, right? And then you got some guy who's probably making about minimum wage. He's going to do the paperwork and unlock the cell, and out he goes. But what happens if the governor comes into town with the sirens? Big motorcade. The governors come to our city, goes down to the jail, goes to the prisoner, opens the door, escorts him out, maybe even puts him in his car. You think that's going to make the 6 o'clock news? Yes. So from that perspective, Betty's right. But from Don's perspective, I think that's also true, that they could have pushed this, and they could have pushed this hard. And if they had lost their jobs, they probably weren't going to get another job like that, and they could have suffered the same punishment. It could have been far, far worse. So they did sort of let them off the hook. They also held them just their feet to the fire a little bit, so it wasn't nearly as bad as it could have been. One old commentator, McGarvey, said, and I like this quote, let me give it to you. The incident justifies Christians in making use of civil laws to protect themselves, but not to inflict punishment on their enemies. I like that. Use civil law to protect yourself, but not to inflict punishment on your enemies. I do believe that that follows that balance right there.
But it's still, with all the magistrates coming to the jail, that still had to be enough of a public discourse.
Yes. That's an excellent observation. That lays the foundation, Lord willing, for next week's class. But I'm not going to go there quite yet. I was going to throw something else out, but Tim will take your thought.
Well, it shows how you can and how you should temper justice with compassion.
Yes.
You don't have to hold people to the letter of the law. You can.
Right.
You can be a little bit soft on it and still get it across that they broke the law or they need some type of punishment, but they don't need to be.
Yeah, and that's what you have here. The Bible says, as you look down there, let's take a look at 38 again. The sergeants reported these words unto the magistrates, and they did what? They feared. It wasn't just the humiliation. These guys were terror because they knew, this goes back to the point that Don was making, they knew that this could be a really, really big problem for them. So being a Christian sometimes means that we do accept wrong. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse